I'm at UC Davis in the sociology department, and my thesis is a comparison of two large, by which I mean more than 100 member, worker-owned cooperatives. One has 120 employees right now, and the other has about 210. So this is beyond face-to-face kind of control. It's not small groups of friends. It's large and often needing some kind of bureaucratic mediation groups. But what's interesting about them is they're both 25 to 30 years old. And they started as small, hippie, dropout collectives with, you know, mostly middle-class white folks getting paid very low wages and kind of everyone doing everything very groovy. And today they're very successful economically. Members make well above industry averages. They're also mostly folks from working-class backgrounds. They're very racially diverse. And you know, they're very different looking than the co-ops of the 60s and 70s. But what's interesting about them is that while one of them has also developed very hierarchical management with a CEO, managers, sub-managers, and management gets paid salary, non-management gets paid hourly, the other one, and the larger one, has no management, just elected committees and a very decentralized form of running things on a day-to-day basis. So I'm looking at how that difference in control manifests itself in terms of how power and resources, money, stuff, gets distributed by race, class, gender, sexuality.
Mm-hmm. And what got you started in this? What got you really interested in the whole kind of worker co-op issue?
Well, I came to grad school with a very different project, a completely different, much more historical project, looking at construction of race on the left. And I couldn't find any faculty who wanted to work with me and who I wanted to work with. And there were two people in the department who I thought were great and seemed to be really good to their students, and they both did issues around work. And one day my housemate came back from the Western Worker Cooperative Conference, which is held up in Oregon, and it's a gathering of folks who work in worker cooperatives. And he had been at a meeting. He also worked in one of the worker cooperatives that later became one of the ones in my study, which I call One World Natural Grocery. I have confidentiality agreements with both of these, so I can't give, you know, say what their actual names are, so I call them One World Natural Grocery, which is the larger one, the decentralized one, and People's Daily Bread Bakery, which is the smaller one with management. So apparently the CEO had said that people from working class backgrounds do not want to spend all their time in meetings, and that when worker cooperatives ask people to run their own businesses and sit in meetings, they're basically asking them to use skills that are honed through middle-class participation, middle-class institutions. Mm-hmm. So it's setting working people up to fail by asking them to do all these kind of day-to-day management and long-range planning things. And you know, working people, what they want is to own their business and to see the profits that they create. The real problem, he thought, was that, you know, traditional corporations basically take the fruits of people's labor from them. And that's the main issue. It's not control. So I thought about that, and I thought, wow, is that really true? Are worker cooperatives that have decentralized control, participatory democracy, are they basically just places for middle-class white folks to hide out? So when I looked at the other one, the one that had participatory control, I found that its race and class composition was almost identical to the People's Daily Bread Bakery. So that really couldn't explain it. And that's when I got really interested, was how I was able to get my faculty members interested, and how I started this project in the fall of 2001.
Okay. Wow. So so how did you approach these particular institutions? Were they happy to help you with your research? Or was this kind of, you're messing in our kind of internal politics, we're not really interested?
It wasn't easy getting in. I mean, it took kind of talking with a lot of people. They weren't sure what I wanted to do, why I wanted to study it. But what we have in common, both, you know, these organizations and me, all three of us as entities, is that we really are very committed to getting the word out that there are other ways to manage and be successful at work. So I think they were excited that I was going to be talking about worker cooperatives, successful worker cooperatives. And I was excited about that, too. And you know, and I just want to say that while I've been very delighted to see how participatory management can happen in a class and racially diverse environment, and gender diverse as well. I don't think that the other co-op, People's Daily Bread, is bad because they have management, and they have some other features that One World doesn't have, which make it very interesting and in fact extend a certain form of economic democracy more widely across particularly race, I would say, in terms of distributing the profits.
So, well, you said that you don't think it's particularly bad. It's just, how do you see that as a, is there a strength in that kind of more centralized management aspect?
Well, they're still here. They're still here. They feel that they could not have succeeded, they could not have continued without moving to this model. And they are more financially stable, more successful. They're distributed nationally and internationally. They have a product that just ships really well, so they're able to do that. And they are, you know, paying their workers really well. So, you know, we're talking about an area of California that has gone through, like much of California, has gone through incredible inflated property values.
Right.
And yet folks who have, you know, jobs in a bread factory are able to buy houses, young folks. And I do think that's wonderful. I think there need to be a lot of available models of worker cooperatives out there, so that people who haven't had experience with that before can see what model works for them, what model they might want to pursue. I think there are benefits and losses to each of them, probably. But the more worker cooperatives out there, the better, I think.
Would you say that there's one that's kind of a particular model? How would people maybe define a worker cooperative then? I mean, what are the basic elements of that?
Well, I think there's a very popular imagination of what a worker cooperative or worker collective is,
okay.
You know, and you probably, a lot of the folks you've interviewed probably, you know, struggle with this as well, which is, you're not the boss of me, right? No bosses. At the place with the hierarchical management, they say that's a big problem with them. At the place with no management, however, workers constantly tell me, it's not like there are no bosses. It's like there's 100 bosses. You know, there's sort of the eye is always on you. Your coworker is always looking at you. So that's, you know, this is just a myth to put to rest. But I think that, you know, the main thing that a worker cooperative is and does is that, and many of your guests have said this, is that it returns the profits to the people who create them. It, you know, returns that value to them. But beyond that, beyond worker ownership, there's also worker control. And I think a lot of people have a hard time imagining how all the jobs could get done, you know, what all the dirty jobs are that no one wants to do. And people have a hard time imagining, how do you make someone come in at, you know, midnight, when work has to get done at midnight, things like that. But it does seem to work out pretty well. What's interesting to me at the cooperative that doesn't have management is that there seem to be far fewer jobs that are considered really dirty or really undesirable. It seems that once people sort themselves out, a lot of jobs that might have been considered undesirable, well, there's someone who actually desires that.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they want to do, and it works out pretty well.
In any of these places, in any of the worker co-ops that you've checked out, at least in your research or to compare maybe, is there much kind of rotation of jobs, or does everyone pretty much have a very specialized kind of function that they're actually hired for?
That's a good question. I think in smaller co-ops there tends to be a lot more rotation. In larger co-ops there tends to be less. In my research, in the two I'm comparing, the bread bakery has almost no job rotation. Within the production department they will rotate through various positions, but that's more of an ergonomic thing. It's kind of seen as saving their body rather than someone might bake and ship and do office work. That never happens.
Oh, okay.
That never happens.
Because the skills are similar in the production process.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. They're similar. They're seen as similar enough. And they have separate departments, you know, separate work groups, and different managers and different pay scales. So they see, you know, it would be very difficult for them. Like, how would you be a sanitation worker, which gets paid this much, and then be an office worker, which gets paid, you know, how would that work out? At the other place, at the grocery store, people primarily work within one department. They have what they call a home department, and that's where their paycheck gets negotiated. But they may work shifts in other departments. And often, it seems to me, someone who started there 10 years ago is unlikely to be in the same department they were at. There are some people who are, but for the most part, people do try out different places, do try out different jobs, and, you know, life things change. People may start off really enjoying a very physical job, and as their bodies age and they age, they may want a less physical job. They may want less customer contact. Some people want more customer contact. Some people want to work fewer hours and need a type of job that allows them to work fewer hours, things like that.
What about, is there a kind of a sense within this, particularly the grocery one, that different departments or different kind of home areas are more desirable to everyone, or like, would you want to go towards more of an office job, you know, or is that not really even considered a kind of a better quality department, you know what I'm saying?
It's a really interesting question. I think there's a lot of resistance to the office at both sites. At both sites, they're seen as kind of goal-breaking. They don't really work. They don't do hard work, because at both sites, it's primarily hard physical labor that's required. On the other hand, some people think, oh, that's such an easy job. You know, it's such an easy, great job. That's where I want to work. So there's a little bit, but mostly I'd say people don't want to work in the office. In the grocery store, people who don't cashier tend to think of cashiering as a really hard, an undesirable job, because there's a lot of customer contact, and it's kind of the end of the customer's time in the store, and they tend to be the rudest that they're going to be at that stage. And they are. They are so rude. It you know, spending time with them really blew my mind. But people in the cashier department often say they wouldn't work anywhere else. I think they're physically separated from the rest of the store, and I think they feel that a little bit. But whereas, you know, in some ways it does seem like a hard job, it's much more repetitive, you're locked in one place, you can't walk away from a customer as easily if they're being rude. Although, unlike Safeway, if the customer is being rude, you can say, you know what, I'm shutting down my line, you can go get someone else. I mean, having a rude customer is seen as a problem that can be dealt with by a worker clock.
I mean, unlike Safeway. So, tell us, where do you find that most kind of worker cooperatives are located in the United States? Or would you say more on the West Coast and East Coast, or because the East Coast is an older, kind of a, you know, more historically settled area, are there maybe more over there? You know, I wonder if this is related to kind of timing of, like, more appearing in the 60s and 70s.
I think at this point there are more here. Mm-hmm. The West Coast has had actually a very long tradition of both worker and consumer cooperatives. The forestry industry at the West Coast was largely worker cooperative in a way that it wasn't in the Southeast. There was a very long tradition of worker cooperatives on the East Coast, but there were four waves of worker cooperatives. There's starting in the 19th century or 18th century from the Rochdale folks over in England, Europe and America developed this worker cooperative communities. It was a real resistance to increasing industrialization. But by the end of the 19th century, there was a lot of criticism because they tend to have very high buy-in. And that's still the problem with a lot of worker cooperatives. To join, to become a member, you have to come up with a fair amount of cash. And basically, these worker cooperatives were raising money, you know, raising capital the same way capitalists do, which was by having non-member labor doing their work and profiting off of them. And so there's a real resistance to, you know, bring them in as members, even if they could afford to buy in. And there's a notice that these cooperatives tended to either fail economically or degenerate into kind of small privately held companies where you often had more employees who weren't members than members who were owning. And as politically, as more revolutionary communism became more important, ideas of socialism being able to be extended through unions, the cooperatives tended to fall apart, get minimized, it became less important. The Finns were the ones who really kept cooperatives alive in this country.
Really? Tell us a little bit about that.
I don't know a whole lot.
Okay.
It was mostly in the Midwest, but they had a lot of cooperative associations and had producer and worker and agricultural co-ops and kind of kept the form alive because it was very big in Finland. But they kept some of these going, so then when the New Deal came along and was trying to figure out ways to, you know, bring workers in without having to kind of dismantle capitalism completely,
mm-hmm.
They co-opted the form and often would bring together groups that were, you know, we would not describe as real homogenous now, but really tried to minimize differences between the members of the worker cooperatives, while at the same time getting them to produce. You know, they would get some capitalization from the government, they'd start making stuff, they'd start making money, you know, get on people's feet, but it was very much coordinated through the government.
Mm. So they could maybe seize control at some point when things were up and running, or did they actually stay worker?
They stayed worker-controlled, although there were factions within that, and the government was, you know, would be aiding some. And it was patchy. You know, it depended on the local government involvement.
Yeah.
But basically, when industry got on its feet again and the New Deal fell apart, there was nothing really holding the worker cooperatives together. Also, a lot of these were in rural areas, and as industrialization proceeded apace, people were leaving rural areas and moving to the urban areas for work, and they disintegrated.
Mm-hmm. And then the 60s, maybe?
Well, they fell apart pretty much by the mid-late 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And then the wave that you saw happening in the mid-late 60s and early 70s was really quite different, because whereas Rushdale had sort of a how-do-you-change-your-life aspect to it, but the New Deal cooperatives were really much more about getting workers their fair share.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't about how work happens, how work is controlled, the quality of work life. That wasn't really so much an issue. It was like, how do you get food on the table? How do you make something sustainable? In the 60s and 70s, what you saw was a real critique of industrial life, a real critique of hierarchy, of bureaucracy, of all those things, you know, the real do-your-own-thing kind of co-op, figure it all out and start anew. And there are some wonderful things that happened out of these cooperatives, you know, I think including a critique of work life that hadn't happened in a structured way.
That wasn't happening elsewhere,
It certainly wasn't happening elsewhere in the work world.
Mm-hmm.
It was happening politically, of course, in other places. I mean, the worker cooperatives were really part of larger political groups that were also criticizing what was going on with party politics, what democracy was, how democracy was seen. So there's a real questioning of how do we, you know, what control is and what community control would mean. Those were the studies that scholars, those were the cooperatives that scholars began to study. And so there's this whole flurry, because scholarship was always a little late, of studies that started coming out in the mid to late 70s through the early 80s. But, you know, these cooperatives, this last wave, had real problems. They tended to have, and there have been some very good studies of these. They tended not to look at, you know, why they were these homogenous, largely homogenous groups. You know, they were generally children of privilege. They were largely educated, highly educated. They came from middle-class families. And so, when their salaries couldn't, you know, fill all their needs, they had other resources on which they could rely from their families who had property, because property in America has been the primary way that and primarily white Americans have increased in wealth from generation to generation. And folks from working class backgrounds, people of color who've been excluded from those property structures, who've been excluded from property ownership by banking, don't have those sorts of resources. So you can have all the, you know, idealism and desire for a better job that does better work, that, you know, is right livelihood of not harming others and all that stuff. But, if, you know, if you can't live on it. Exactly. Exactly. And they tended to be small, and they tended to try to stay small.
Mm.
You know, part of that was seen as bringing in bonds of friendship, bonds of family, really caring about each other, bringing in the whole self to the workplace.
Right.
One of the critiques was that the workplace tended to shut down people's emotions, shut down their connections to each other, didn't build community. these worker cooperatives were seen as being able to do that.
And did they base this on models that they saw worked, or they'd say, well, this is kind of idealistic that we could do this, and let's give it a shot and make some money at the same time?
I think there's a mix. I mean, you have, you know, you also have in Israel a large worker cooperativist movement, you know, co-ops on the land, agricultural co-ops, co-ops in the cities. One of the largest public transportation companies is still a worker cooperative there. But it was part of the nation-building project, you know, which makes it complicated, problematic, and if we can just set that aside for today, I appreciate it. So I think there were some models that they were able to look at. And there were some large models going on in some of the Eastern Bloc countries, in Hungary and in Yugoslavia. There were large attempts at mixed control between workers, local governments, and, well, workers and local governments, basically. But a lot of it was self-invention. Mm-hmm. A lot of it was. But of course, a lot of it also replicated larger social patterns. So when you have, for instance, a group of people who really... there's a great study by a woman called, Cheryl Kleinman, called Opposing Ambitions. And she's looking at an alternative healing arts center that was worker collective. And there's she finds a very depoliticized sense of what it was to be a worker. So what happens is that the men who were seen as being able to reap greater rewards in the outside world were, you know, like, wow, you're so great. It's so cool that you're willing to come down to our little healing arts center and donate your time. So they got a lot more status and they were able to negotiate better fees. Whereas the women, who were mostly working in the offices, were seen as housewives, or it's just kind of like, wow, you know, she's really getting a lot of value out of being here, so she doesn't really need money. Mm-hmm. So without an analysis of gender, you know, in the larger world, how gender works, they wound up replicating a lot of really messed up gender patterns within the workplace. There's a scholar named Carmen Siriani who's looked at feminist nonprofits and how they're sort of decentralized. What he refers to as structurelessness, borrowing from Joe Friedman's article, The Tyranny of Structurelessness. And he sees how white women are able to mobilize their sense, their kind of cultural capital, if you were, the ways that they learn how to talk and interact and the knowledge they have. And they were able to transform that into authority within these feminist nonprofits. And he argues that hierarchical structure really works much better with a heterogeneous population, with difference, where you have formal structures where people, you know, can't just say, well, I really think, you know, that this is a good idea and we should do this, and they have this weight of kind of knowing the way the system works behind them. And they get to, you know, even though they don't have a title, mm-hmm. they still wind up directing things. Mm-hmm. And this tended to be the white women he found mm-hmm. in these groups. So there's been a lot of study that says when you don't really address what's going on socially, you know, if you don't have structural ways of dealing with structural problems, that, and this is what we saw with those co-ops, you're going to have just explosions of, you know, horrible feeling around race, around class, around gender, around sexuality. And a lot of the small co-ops went down in flames around personal stuff as much as around poor business decisions, lack of, you know, investment, inability to attract capital. You know, also some of the major capitalist groups moving in on these little markets mm-hmm. that these niche, you know, markets had developed. Like
they colonized, essentially.
They colonized, like health food stores, mm-hmm. right? You know, you start with the groovy little health food stores, and now you have, you know, the Whole Foods megaplex somewhere.
Right. Interesting. Let's take a musical break, and then we'll come back to this really good discussion. And again, this is In the Meantime on Enemy Combatant Radio. I'm DJ Sweetie. I'm speaking here with Joan Myers, and we're going to come back in just a couple minutes.